Hello, everybody. So my name is Jeff Hoffman, and I'd like to recognize my co-author, the celebrated Stephen Wallace, who's been on most of these papers. So I'll be talking about caregivers today, but in particular, not their physical or mental health, but their economic stability, something that often seems to go overlooked. I have no financial disclosures to divulge. As a brief overview, we're all pretty familiar with the status of the baby boomers and aging in California, but as has already been mentioned, it's a rapidly aging population. We have the nation's largest population of boomers. Currently over 10% of the state's population are 65 plus, and the oldest old population, as they're called, are actually expected to double by 2030, which is a severe challenge for a lot of our services and policies that we currently have for seniors. As an overview of some of the policies that we have, obviously Medicaid covers some long-term care services, and we spend about half of our Medicaid dollars for long-term care services on home and community-based services, HCBS. And people seem to have a preference for long-term care services in the community as opposed to being placed within institutions. So obviously this will continue to be a problem that we need to address. How do we keep people, older adults, within the community with the sorts of supports that they need and take into account the cost? Now, obviously, nursing homes cost about $250 a day, so there is a cost argument to be made about keeping people in the community, although that's a pretty contentious debate. In terms of the policy climate in California, and I'm going to get to my research question in a moment, but you should know, if you don't already, there have been a lot of turbulence in the policy climate over the past few years. California, the state budget, has obviously been undergoing a lot of dramatic changes and pushes for cuts to budgets, and those inevitably come down. The axe comes down on seniors, supportive services for seniors. Catherine talks a lot about this in the presentations I've seen of hers. Governor Brown, some of the ones that affect home care workers, Governor Brown vetoed an overtime pay and labor protection act just recently. He's also going full steam ahead with pushing dual eligibles into managed care, and that is likely to have uncertain effects. We certainly don't know, researchers and policymakers, what sort of effects that will have on the home care population and care recipients, which I'll discuss in a moment. And some other changes you can see up here, which were also pretty dramatic with the adult day health care switch to CVAS. So today I'm going to be talking a lot about the In-Home Supportive Services Program, or IHSS. I'm sorry, we're sort of short on time, I can't go too much into it, but it is the largest community-based long-term care services program in California. It has an estimated enrollment of about a little over 400,000. It's growing, according to the Legislative Analyst Office, and we spend about $5 billion a year on it. It is jointly funded by the state and the federal government, as well as local entities. And what does IHSS do? It basically provides in-home care if one can't safely remain in the home. It's a pretty innovative program because it's consumer-directed, and what that means is that you can actually hire a family member or a friend. You can ask the local entity, local jurisdiction. They often have a pool of IHSS providers, so if you don't have a family member, you can hire one through there. And you can actually hire, train, and fire, if need be, the caregiver. So today I'll be talking about mostly a descriptive study about the economic impact, not really the impact, the causal impact, but the economic situation of IHSS caregivers using California Health Interview Survey. So you can see some of the descriptives of the CHIS data. We know that there are about an estimated 6 million informal caregivers or formal caregivers in the past 12 months, that is, in California, and of those you can see that about 12% are paid caregivers, and of those about half, or 290,000 total, were paid and assisted care recipients who have Medicaid. So for the purpose of this study, we are estimating that a large proportion of those are actually IHSS providers. So this is not IHSS data from the Department of Social Services, but it's as close as we can get to sort of estimating who they are. This about lines up with the estimated, with the actual number of IHSS providers in the program across the state. So the research question is, how are these folks doing economically? And I'll compare them to other caregivers in the state, as well as non-caregivers. Here's a basic overview, and On the right, you have the national statistics for national caregivers from a different survey, and on the left, these what we're calling IHSS providers. So as you can see, IHS providers tend to care more for non-relatives, or rather non-parental or non-spousal relatives and or friends compared to national caregivers. They also care a little more each week in terms of the duration of care on a weekly basis. They've been caring a median of 5.5 years, which is a little different from the national caregiver statistics. And on the bottom row, you can see, and this is what I'll get into, is that their incomes are substantially lower compared to national caregivers, which is borne out by some of the slides that will come below. So we've selected a number of measures of economic stability. And so the first will just be the monthly income. So this is self-reported, bear in mind. You can see on the left, the IHSS providers have significantly lower, and these everything I'll be showing you is statistically significant with weighted data, but you can see that their incomes are about half that of unpaid caregivers as well as non-caregivers in the state of California. This is 2009 data. And I should also say that their monthly income translates into about a wage of $11 per hour, and that incorporates their caregiving wage from IHSS as well as additional work that they may be performing. This translates into, we were discussing federal poverty levels earlier, and you can see that the leftmost column in each bar chart, in each column here, is the IHSS providers, and more than half of them live in poverty or near poverty, with near poverty defined as less than 200% FPL. You can see on the right, those who have a little higher income tend to be non-caregivers and actually unpaid caregivers. So there's a clear discrepancy in incomes or poverty levels, if you will, between the unpaid caregiver group and the IHSS provider group, which is surprising because unpaid caregivers are not paid, right? How about job tenure? This will come into play later when I talk about implications for policy, but we see here as well another sort of deficit when it comes to these providers. Although they're paid, they tend to stay in their jobs for less amount of time compared to other Californians who are not caregivers. So you can see not only are they more likely to turn over within 1 year, which means there might be a lot of case turnover, but they're also a lot less likely to be there for shorter amounts of time. They're less likely to be there for a long amount of time, if you will, or even a medium amount of time. How about home ownership? We can also see that there about half of paid Medi-Cal caregivers own their own home compared to about 6 out of 10 non-caregivers. And they're also significantly more likely to rent a home compared to non-caregivers. In terms of the effects of income of these wage earners on their access to health services, you see in this chart that the uninsurance rate, the current uninsurance rate, is about not quite double that of non-caregivers. And in terms of the usual source of care, if we identify a clinician's office as a more appropriate place of care for usual access to health services, we can see that, gosh, non-caregivers, about two-thirds of them have access to a doctor's office, but the self-report of access to doctor's office is significantly lower among our IHSS providers. They're more likely to use the ER or a clinic for their care. And unsurprisingly, this translates into self-reported delays in access, both for medical services and access to prescription drugs. So the story isn't surprising thus far. If you have lower income, everything else seems to follow from that. But it's sort of one factor after another that sort of builds a story about how they're doing. Here is food insecurity, which simply is defined as ability to put enough food on the table each month. And among those who are under 200% of the FPL, almost one in three of these caregivers report food insecurity, which is, as you can see, higher than for non-caregivers, although we'd like to see both of those levels down. And they're also more likely, of those at less than 300% FPL, to receive food stamp benefits. So those were descriptive analyses, sort of bivariate analyses, and then we also wanted to adjust for some demographic characteristics to make sure that the differences that we observed weren't just differences in composition of the two groups that we were looking at, but there were actually differences in outcomes adjusting for some of the demographic differences. So we controlled for age, gender, race, ethnicity, and education level. And we can see that the results sort of hold after adjustment. The first one is a linear regression, the rest are logistic, which I've converted the odds ratios to relative risks because these are fairly frequent outcomes. The lower monthly incomes are about $1,000 per month less, so they're making about $23,000 a year compared to about $48,000 for non-caregivers, and that's borne out even after adjustment for the characteristics. Greater food insecurity, about 1.5 times the likelihood of reporting insecurity, half the likelihood of having job tenure for tenure period or greater, and 1.5 times the risk of current uninsurance. So what does this all mean? So as I said, sort of tells a story that's unsurprising once we learn how little they make, but these are paid caregivers, so it is a little bit, doesn't necessarily pass the smell test when you first hear it. You would imagine that they'd be doing okay. This is a really innovative program that provides an opportunity for family members to direct their own care, so it actually is, according to many researchers and experts, a sort of a wonderful model for what other states could do for their caregivers and care recipients. And yet, we seem to be leaving out of the discussion some of the economic vulnerability of these caregivers. And one would tend to think that informal caregivers are the ones that we should be most concerned about. They're sort of in a funny group. The families aren't poor enough to have the care recipient qualify for Medi-Cal. And so those who do fall into that boat clearly are economically vulnerable. We still need to be concerned about the middle income group. So this story isn't to say, hey, let's focus all our attention on this particular group of IHS providers. In terms of earlier research, our findings sort of are concordant with what's been observed before amongst IHSS providers in Northern California. Two surveys about a decade ago showed similar poverty levels and very low incomes. So if you adjust for inflation, they're fairly similar. And I thought what was really interesting is there was a study that came out that talked about what are some of the actual implications of low wages. So instead of just saying, gosh, these people are suffering, what else does it mean in terms of the care for the care recipients? So this study actually did a very sophisticated econometric analysis and found that wage rates and benefits were actually associated in many important ways with job retention, or if you will, in the inverse sense, job turnover. And job turnover, as we know, is probably not very good for care recipients. One would hope that a caregiver would be around enough time, particularly if it's not a family member, to learn how to do the job, to be concordant in their roles with the preferences of the care recipients. And so they found actually significant declines in turnover rates with small increases in, San Francisco had introduced a living wage. And once that happened, at the population level, they observed less job turnover, which is sort of fascinating. And then they ran some regressions and found, as you can see, some really interesting results. A $1 increase in the wage rate was associated with a 12 percentage point increase in the probability of staying in the workforce more than 1 year. And it was actually linear and incremental. Look at the bottom bullet point. Probability for remaining 1 year substantially increases with wages at $6.75, $8, and $10. Now, why is this an issue? Here's some more stuff about IHS providers, but I'll direct your attention to the bottom of the slide. The state currently provides a big chunk of the funding for IHSS. The funding mechanism is like a higher calculus problem, I find. But broadly speaking, the state pumps in, you know, a substantial amount of it, and the federal government kicks in a match amount for the Medicaid part, and localities chip in about 17%. But the state is currently, on average, paying up to about $12 per hour per provider in wages and benefits. However, as I mentioned, the policy climate under Schwarzenegger and even under Brown, there have been proposed cuts both in the service hours, which are currently at about 277 hours per month. They wanted to cut those by up to 20%. That's currently in the courts, the federal courts. There's a stay on that right now. But they also want to reduce the amount that they're kicking in, providing to the localities who then give it to the IHSS providers. So they were going to cut that by couple dollars. So I've just laid out the case for why what sounds nominal, just a couple dollars, may actually be pr- problematic not just for the economic security of these paid caregivers, but the quality of care if one agrees that job turnover leads to worse quality of care for care recipients in California. And given the aging status of our population, in my mind, this creates a policy incentive to really think more carefully about the types of cuts we're making to important programs like IHSS. One good piece of news that in LA County, the Board of Supervisors recently approved a 60-cent per hour raise in the wages, and that was negotiated by SEIU. So here I already mentioned some of these issues, but there's still a lot of policy uncertainty. So I'm suggesting we should pay more attention to what the effects of these cuts can be. Well, actually, more cuts are on the horizon. So the managed care benefit transition was also problematic. So just to conclude, the policy shifts and the budget crisis are imposing strain on the supports and services for seniors. But as I've tried to argue, or we've observed, it's also placing strain on caregivers, a particular subset of those in California. It can lead to economic vulnerability and job turnover. That, in turn, can affect the care, the quality of care for the recipients, and that, in fact, small increases in wages and benefits can have large effects. So these IHSS workers are doing much worse than the non-caregivers and other unpaid caregivers, and these pressures are only likely to increase in the current policy climate. With health reform, there seem to be some opportunities for increased federal match from the federal government, but that's uncertain given the transition to managed care. So really things are up in the air with the decisions in the courts still awaiting verdicts from the federal judges. We could still have 20% cuts in service hours, sort of hemorrhaging of the system that supports vulnerable seniors. So that's all. Thank you.
Discussion then. Questions for any of our panelists? Yes.
Or Josh. When you're saying managed care, are you talking managed care for Medi-Cal recipients? So what is going to be so negative about that? What are the key concerns about managed care for Medi-Cal, because some counties have been doing that already. So what can be really negative?
Well, I think there are a couple concerns. The Legislative Analyst Office seems to be concerned that right now there's a pilot project going on for conversion that's in four counties. Catherine probably knows a lot more about that. But I think it's in four counties, but Governor Brown's proposed budget says no, starting 2013 fiscal year, we want to roll out to all counties that have two plans in the county and the possibility for beneficiaries in managed care. And so some people are concerned, typically when we do a pilot project, such as in Medicare, we do it for 5 years or however long, we test the budget neutrality, we get it evaluated, and then we move forward with broader implementation. Governor Brown is really sort of jumping in. So that's one. In terms of IHSS, the concern is we just don't know how that will affect the dynamics of the funding streams, as well as, yes, right now it's set up in a sort of complex way legally where each jurisdiction runs IHSS in their own way. For instance, I sort of superficially explained the situation in LA. The Board of Supervisors did approve it, but then it goes to an entity which is responsible for the program, and that entity negotiates with an employer of record for the providers, and that can be unions such as SEIU, as I mentioned. But if you switch to managed care, does the managed care organization become, does Aetna or Blue Cross Blue Shield become the employer of record? And will they take a cut? Where does the funding go to at that point? So it just becomes really unclear. And as indicative of the lack of clarity, as I mentioned, the Affordable Care Act actually provides a greater match for home community-based services in some instances. And in this case, California's Governor Brown's proposal still has not gotten approved from HHS, and I think that's because they're really unclear on how this will affect the quality of care and, you know, how the payment streams should work if we do this large-scale conversion. So just all at once.
There's not enough clarity right now to move ahead with that.
There's really not. So,
well, like San Mateo County, for example, has been doing managed care for Medi-Cal for many years. I would assume that there are outcomes. I mean, you know, that there is some data.
They're one of the four counties that have elected because of this, for that reason, largely for that reason.
I see.
So they have it at the county level. I think that, as Doug's saying, that it's the speed of the transition and mm-hmm. stakeholders that are saying, wait a minute, slow down. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, I don't think that the end objective is a negative one. I think everybody agrees that we need more coordinated care mm-hmm. and that there's really good, you know, prospects of getting there, but it's how they're getting there. There's a lot of, you know, the devil in the people.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how IHSS is going to be handled. They're saying IHSS will continue initially, but then there's this sort of cliff that, you know, is out there, like, well, then what happens after 2 years? So I think the uncertainty makes people very, you know, concerned, and given that the population is so vulnerable, people are worried about losing their physicians. There's a lot of information that needs to get out there, and people there's not a clear communication or a streamlined communication. But the state's really, I think, working to try to readdress all of these issues, mm-hmm. and they've been meeting with stakeholders from, you know, all the various stakeholders.
But certainly provided for concern as well.
Yeah.
So SEIU and the other organizers and labor think, well, wait a minute, what's in this for us? We're barely hanging on, mm-hmm. you know, at all. And you know, now we're able to collectively bargain with boards of supervisors or other entities which are responsible for administering these programs. What happens if I say to the provider pool that offer providers to those care recipients who don't select a family member? Who does Aetna run those now? And I think providers have every reason to be a little concerned who's fighting for their interests when you switch to privately managed plans.
Yeah,
now, I'm sure there's a way to resolve it, and I agree with that. And this is probably really good.
Thank you.
Did you have something to contribute to that?
I just wanted to say,
question?
Go UCLA. I'm also from HealthNet. We're one of the counties that HealthNet that have been awarded for Los Angeles and San Diego. And we're working very hard to make sure that the care is coordinated for all the seniors that are coming in. But like you said, there's a lot of unknown from the state. We're waiting from the federal government to give us regulations in terms of what we need to do in order to make the network more robust for our recipients. But the concern is there's no payment rates that have been given to us so that we can even start talking to the doctors about how we can get them into the network and how the care coordination will work. But we're working as hard as we can based on the unknown and based on the anticipated guidelines from CMS.
Right.
So we're creating a robust program and system as possible, and then we'll just have to tweak it once we get the regulations come out.
Yeah.
So, great.
Yes?
I have a question for Kathleen. Did your study interview rural providers or organizations that was strictly?
We try to get a diverse group geographically. We interviewed people from across the country. So, some were people that, word of mouth, a lot of snowballs and who's doing work in this area. And so we did speak to rural counties. We spoke to providers in rural and urban and really worked hard to get a mix. Are there some issues that...
No, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering where you pulled your
example. It's going to be very different. What the needs are and how this is public.
Yes.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. These are really great presentations. Thank you. So the man who just spoke, were you able to look at any interactions between sort of the demographic factors and sort of financial outcomes?
Right. This is a fabulous question. This is a very sort of basic source right now. I should have said, folks, there were no financial disclosures, but it was done by SEIU. And so I did not approach this as a typical research project where I built a conceptual model and ask a development hypothesis and then test it with a model and specification. Instead, it was just sort of a descriptive analysis. So that would be something that I'd be interested in looking into. Do you have a hypothesis of what?
I think it would just be interesting to know, you know, if you sort of compared the paid versus the unpaid caregivers, but in that population of paid caregivers, maybe women are being paid less than men, or, you know, ethnic minorities are being paid less than. So I think that
we already know that currently the direct care workforce is largely women and heavily minority oriented. And I think, you know, at least we know that IHS providers generally within their responsibilities in the IHSS program are being paid comparatively with, you know, the same uniform as well. There could be differences in terms of benefits because you need to work for 2 months straight, a certain amount of hours, 3 months, 2 months, 12 hours, so it could be across groups more need for income as though if you work for benefits or if you have a spouse with benefits or not. So there are a lot of interesting things for working there.
And then I have a question about the elder index.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say that it was based on based on people who had no like chronic condition? Was that one of the?
Oh, so it's somebody in good health. So for our medical costs, we look at MET data and self-reported health question asks, is your health excellent, good, excellent,
very good,
very good, fair, poor. So we looked at good sort of as the medium. And so we do when we actually provide the cost on our website, we do adjust the cost. If somebody's in excellent health, there's a reduction in healthcare costs. If somebody's in fair, poor health, there's an increase. And then we also offer a supplement to the elder index to look at long-term care service costs. Yeah. But we just wanted to provide like an average cost for the average older adult, but we do make those adjustments.
That's great. Because I was just thinking that, you know, I think 75% of elderly adults in the U.S. have at least one chronic condition.
Yeah,
right. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't look at chronic conditions specifically, it's just more self-reported health.
That would be a good thing to look at, chronic condition.
We only work together.
So I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about, given the big gap between what these older adults are making and what their costs are, how are they making ends meet?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think they're having to make really dire decisions between eating or taking their meds. Mm-hmm. And what we're planning to look at it, another family type, possibly, that's still being determined by our advisory board, is looking at older adults who move in together because they need to offset their expenses for housing, right? So then they're rooming together to offset that so that they can eat and take their meds, and, you know, so it's a lot of juggling, I would imagine. Yeah, it is unfortunate that they have to make those decisions, right?
So there's clearly reluctance on the part of the states to embrace this because they're afraid of transfer funding. But you're saying
right.
AOAs,
the AAA.
Yeah.
So this is, we've been trying to pass this, well, if I say we, but the Insight Center has been trying to pass this, get it passed into law for 3 years now. And the backlash the first year was that there was cost pressures, that if we identify more people in need, then we have to provide services for them. So there was a lot of backlash on that, so we had to tone it down. So basically what it is now, but the AAAs were very huge advocates of it, and many were already using it alongside the FPO. So now it was just a matter of getting it adopted and, you know, into the law, that they're now that they're required to use it in their area of planning.
Can you give an example of programs that you use? Where is it? What would that be?
So this is the first year that they will be using it, but I imagine they would be using it for things like identifying older adults that they're helping that fall below the FPL, and then the number of older adults who they might be getting supplemental funding from to provide those who are above the FPL but below like 200% of the FPL maybe. So being able to identify the number of adults who are actually, I think it's powerful to funders to say, you know what, we need more money. We get this amount of money, you know, from federal and state, you know, because of the federal poverty guideline, but then we need this additional money to serve this population. Another example for like somebody who provides services, there's this great housing resident in San Diego run by Paul Downey, the Pottinger Family Housing. And what they do is they use the Elder Index and they use the components of it to say, okay, an older adult in San Diego, say, needs $23,000 a year. Well, if we provide subsidized housing, because housing is such a huge cost, if we reduce that by half, you know, so they're paying half of that per month, then we reduce the income they need for housing. Then if we add meals twice a day, then we're reducing their cost for food by this much, you know. So then you see, well, now what an older adult needed was $23,000, maybe now they only need about $14,000. So it's a way to really tailor certain services in a more informative way.
And the cheapest wood and care and insulin area is, and it's pretty dumpy, $3,000. For an elder person who needs some assistance with ADLs.
Wow.
And that's to fight for $3,000, you can't hardly find it. Wow. Usually they're running minimum $47,000 a month. So is that
beautiful? Yeah. No, and I think this really makes the argument that we need more subsidized housing for older adults. Also. Yeah.
I actually have a question for Brianna. You talk about your sample in the caregiver and care recipient, the gender.
Mm-hmm.
Did that surprise you at all? Because you had considerably more male caregivers and female care recipients, which is a little bit surprising or not with trend. What did you guys think of that?
I'm sorry I didn't mention that. It was a combination of two different cohorts of people, and one of the cohorts was all, it was particularly interviewing male caregivers.
Okay.
And so that's why there was such a large, number, because we know that typically females are the ones providing the care.
Okay.
And so that's why, there was a, specifically in this one cohort, we were looking specifically at male caregivers. But all of the male caregivers, except one, were husbands caring for wives. And so it was husbands caring for wives, and then a couple, sons caring for mothers. And so it wasn't, there was just that one who was a brother-in-law caring for a brother-in-law. So, but yeah, I'm sorry to mention
that. No,
that's
okay.
Yeah.
It's great to have that sample, though,
mm-hmm.
Because it's so, there's not very much information on them,
mm-hmm.
their thoughts and their experiences. So I think it's important to get the male caregiver perspective.
And that was part of the interview, was asking, what role does the man in the family play in caregiving? And we haven't analyzed it yet, but just, from listening to all of the transcripts, lots of them are saying, well, same as the woman. And, with just a couple of them saying, well, I've realized that I don't know of any of my other friends who care for, but I still think it's okay. So, starting, I can't say definitively because they haven't analyzed it yet, but, just from remembering what I've read and heard, and that's, so that was part of the interview talking about the man's role, the Mexican man's role in care, providing care.
For his mother, and that side, I think, would be very interesting to
Exactly. There were some who provided, very
personal
care, mm-hmm. whereas others, said, well, if it ever came to that, we would definitely get someone else,
mm-hmm.
So kind of split there.
Interesting. Any other questions? This has been an interesting, lively discussion. Anybody else? Well, I'm sure our leading panelists. will, or leading researchers on our panel, will stay after if you have questions or want to talk with them. Thank you all for coming. Go Giants. And you guys are...